Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of The Op-Ed Page with me, Elisa Kamahort Page. It's my weekly look at everything that's catching my eye, piquing my interest, and causing me to dig a little deeper across the worlds of politics, pop culture, pandemics, technology, activism, you name it. This week, I have two things I want to talk about. And the first is just a sort of reorienting and centering of my own perspective on activism for the year 2022, which is, on the one hand, a very, very important year when it comes to what's going on politically, and on the other hand, probably the seventh year in a row that has felt like it's going to be the most important year of our lifetime. Like, you know how they say that about every election, it's the most important election of your lifetime. And for the last 7 years, every year has felt like that. So how do you keep going and how do you stay energized? And it was one of my goals during the two-week holiday break to try to figure out how to re-energize my own flagging spirit. So I'm going to talk a little bit about that. And then I know it's almost a throwback at this time, but I went and rewatched all of season 2 of Ted Lasso over the holiday, mostly because I wanted to watch it knowing what happens with Nate the Snake and see if I could follow the thread of you know, how he came to the end that he did in the season. And I have some thoughts. Spoiler alert, and that's why it's the second piece in the podcast, so that if you don't want to hear it, you can skip over it. And then, of course, I'll end with quick takes, which is just, there's obviously in the last however many weeks since I did my last episode, there's been a whole lot that I've watched and read, and I'm going to share some of it with you. So sit back, relax, grab your glass of wine, your cup of coffee, put on your walking shoes, get behind the wheel, whatever it is you do when you listen to podcasts, get ready, because here we come. I mentioned when I went off to the holiday break that there were some things, some goals I had. I wanted to rest. I wanted to read. And one of the goals I had was to re-energize my own sense of activism and purpose in activating, because I think by the time I reached the end of 2021, I was pretty sick of my fellow humans, pretty sick of people, most certainly on the right and the whole misinformation miasma we've got going on. But I was pretty sick of people on the left too. I was pretty sick of everybody and had lost my faith a little bit. And I began to, I think, lose my faith that any of my individual action was going to make much difference at this point, that we were going very far down a road. And that is, that whole feeling is pretty much antithetical to the whole point of the book I co-wrote with my friends Carolyn Juran and Jamia Wilson, Roadmap for Revolutionaries, Resistance, Activism, and Advocacy for All, the point of which was to say that no matter who you are and what you care about, there is a way to get activated, and activism can look a lot of different ways. And sure, it can be about the money you donate, and it can be the time you have to contribute, and it can be about your skills, and it can be about all sorts of different things. And it doesn't have to be, you know, Washington, D.C. It can be local government. And it doesn't even have to be local government. It can be activating in your workplace or activating in your kids' schools, activating in the local community, whatever it is. So one of the things I wanted to go over, and in hopes really of helping myself, but in so doing, maybe helping others, is to remember the advice that after the book was published, that I went out on the road all around this country and talked to people about how to build your own personal roadmap to be the kind of activist that you want to be and a more effective everyday activist. So I'm going to walk you through the 4 steps, and I'm going to think about them for myself, because I think I need that reminder, and maybe you do too. So the first step, it's kind of the most important one in a world where there are a million things that you care about that are not going the way you want them to go, and that is to triage. Step one is to triage. When it comes to where you're going to actually devote your time, your research, your energy, you have to pick just a couple of issues that you care most about and focus. Now, that sounds really hard. I care about 25 different things, but I can't be an expert in 25 different things. I have to rely on others to be the experts in some things. And sure, when they raise the call that now is the time, send your money here, or now is the time, call your senator there. I listen to them, but I can't be the one issuing that call. So that's all it means. It doesn't mean to abandon all the other issues that you care about. It means that when it comes to where you're going to read it, what you're going to read up on and get to be really knowledgeable about, what you're going to focus on, if you're going to, you know, contribute your time and energy, the bulk of it should only really be going to one, two, at most, maybe three issues. And then you can be a leader in those areas. And yeah, you can be a follower in some of the others and find your leaders. If you care about it, but it just can't be your number one, find the leaders. So that's number one, is to kind of triage and really be honest with yourself about what you care most about, and what you're going to care about enough to stick with it and keep trying, even when things seem really dark and dire. Because every issue I care about has gone through that cycle in the last 5 years, 7 years even now. The pandemic has kind of destroyed my sense of time. It's like the last 2 years seem like they both lasted forever and never happened. So when I think about 2015, which would have been really to me when things started ramping up to be more terrible than they had been before. You know, that's 7 years ago by now. It's just like, which kind of blows my mind. Anyway, so triage. Step number two is join. And that is, don't try to go it alone. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. You don't need to, even if you're going to be a leader, you don't need to be a leader by creating something new. You might be filling a gap that doesn't exist. So for example, abortion is a great issue. Is a great example of an issue where, wherever you are in this country, I'm going to guarantee you there are localized groups. There may be a local Planned Parenthood. There may be a localized abortion fund or some other localized group that's trying to help women right there where you are. You don't need to necessarily create a new organization. You can go be a clinic escort at a clinic that already exists. You can join up with people who are really, really well schooled in your area's local political dynamics. Because absolutely, I think it's clear that abortion is going to become a battle that is fought locality by locality, state by state. So that doesn't mean that in our book, we have a couple of examples of people who couldn't find a group to join and that no one was really looking at it from their perspective. And so they did create something new, and that's great, but be pretty sure. And if you decide, as I know so many people have decided that, for example, racial justice is their number one or two or three issue, but they themselves are white, go work with groups that are led by the people most affected. Same goes if you decide that LGBTQ issues are really your primary issues. And this can be even if you have children, for example. Maybe you're fired up about an issue because it affects your child. I still would go find an organization or a group that is run and led and has significant input and voice participation from adults, from people who are within that identity group. So join up, aggregate your power, aggregate your energy. There is strength in numbers. That's just true. Just like in entrepreneurism, like people use Mark Zuckerberg as an example. And then I usually say, well, you're not going to be Mark Zuckerberg. Sure, somebody's going to be like that, but odds are it's not going to be you. It's not going to be me. So let's leave him aside as the example. So I could say the same in this case where, like, sure, Greta Thunberg basically single-handedly created her school strike for the environment and became this singular figure. But chances are you and I are not going to be Greta Thunberg. So go find the Greta Thunberg you want to support. I guess that's kind of my point about what is most useful for most people to be more effective everyday activists. The third step is to figure out how you can contribute and take that way beyond the dollar. So, can you contribute your time? Can you be, you know, a lot of people don't feel comfortable marching right now, whether if they have immune issues or if they have, they're taking care of elderly parents, whatever the reason. But if you're not in that position and you can be the feet on the street at a protest or a rally or a vigil or a march, then be that person. Feet on the street really do matter. And money matters and time matters. And for many nonprofits, materials matter. There's a lot of ways to contribute. Letter writing matters. Postcards matter. Phone calls matter. Petitions matter. You know, we need everybody doing something so that everything gets done. So figure out what you have to contribute. For me, some of that I do, I try to be really specific about. So I try to be really specific that I'm going to donate 10% of whatever my very variable income as a consultant is. That's how much money I have to allocate to causes. So I like to do it by percentage. So, you know, it grows as my income grows, or it can ease off as my income eases off. And I don't feel like I am, that's a bad thing. I feel like I've planned for what allocation of my, in this case, money, but you could do the same with time. What allocation of your time? So that's the third thing, contribute. The fourth thing is take the win. And this is a hard one. And it's something I really see my fellow left-leaning folks have real trouble with, which is that we talk so much about everything going wrong that we create the scenario and environment where people think it doesn't make a difference. It doesn't make a difference who's in power, doesn't make a difference who's in office, doesn't make a difference, you know, who, it just doesn't make a difference because things are always super bad. And I think that's really dangerous. I can disagree with many things that many Democrats do. I can disagree with things the Biden administration is doing. I can be disappointed. I can be all these things. But I also know there's just a huge chunk of angst and anger and stress and grief that is not out there weighing on me because it is an administration that is operating under values that I support more than the previous administration. It is not perfect, far from it. It is doing some things I don't like. No politician will do everything I like. No party represents everything I like. But when I talk about it like it's as bad in every aspect that it's all terrible, I think you play into the hands of the people who want to feed this misinformation, which we know happened in the 2016 election. Misinformation targeted Black communities particularly and other communities to make them not necessarily vote for the other side, but to make them not want to vote at all. And if we know anything, 2022, which may indeed be a bloodbath, I don't know, but it doesn't have to be. It is unfortunately a turnout game. Like, do we wish that we didn't have to turn, you know, it's like that whole be twice as better to get half as far. That's what Democrats are basically in that position in this country because of the way the Electoral College works, because of the way the districts are drawn, because of the disproportionate representation that the small states get. And many of those smaller states are red states, you know, so there's a whole disadvantage that way, way more people in aggregate are voting to get just the same number of Democratic seats, for example, in Congress. It requires way more people voting. Is that awesome? No, it is not. Do I think voting rights is really super important? Absolutely, I do. Do I think if we don't get those voting rights protected that people should just give up? No, that's kind of not an option. So that being said, my point was to, there are wins happening. There are things happening at the local, state, county, and national level where things are going in the direction you want, whatever that direction is. You can find the things that you feel good about. And you got to take those wins and celebrate them and do it loudly and do it, you know, so that everybody knows that you're happy about what you're happy about. Because just like, you know, we know that negative reinforcement works, but positive reinforcement works just as well in the political sphere. And, you know, being a voice for what you're being, you know, talking about what you're for, not just what you're against, is actually also the way I really believe you can penetrate some folks who seem like they might be impenetrable, and really make more of a case for what you believe in. So take those wins. Don't only focus on the losses. And in fact, you know, I've been thinking more and more lately about, I may just create a list of my actual favorite people on Twitter and not follow my main feed anymore, because you know what? It's filled mostly with people who, when they were, you know, I know that politically I side with them. I know that I believe in the same values, but I've begun to realize that they got into such a routine of pointing out every flaw and complaining about everything that happens. They got into such a routine of that that they cannot stop. And they're doing it just as much now that they got the guy in office that they preferred. And again, I'll just hasten to say, not perfect, plenty disappointed in some stuff, but you know what? It's miles better for me, you know, from my perspective, not for me personally. It's miles better. He's reversing some terrible environmental executive orders. He's reversing other things. They've gotten some laws passed that are really helpful. Like, stuff is happening, and we can't let that go by unnoticed. I'm going to share in the show notes a Twitter feed that I just discovered today, in fact, which is about what is actually getting done. Like, what positive things are getting done by the Biden administration. But I'm not just talking about at the national level. I'm talking about in general, locally, in your state. What is the stuff that's going right? And talk about that as much as the stuff you talk about that's going wrong. Because I think contributing to a general malaise isn't going to be the answer, particularly if we're not successful beating back voter suppression. Like, we need people energized and excited about getting more good shit done. And it's hard. Like, I know it's hard. But that is my advice. Triage your issues. Decide what you're going to be a leader on and what you're going to be a supporter on. Join and aggregate with other people who care. Don't try to reinvent the wheel. Don't try to be the lone person out there. Find the other people who are already activating and support their work, particularly if they're the ones who are most affected. Follow their lead. Contribute, and contribute in more ways than one, and consider everything you have at your disposal, including you have a big social media following. That's an asset at your disposal. Use it. And finally, take the wins when you can, because it can sometimes feel like they're far and few between, or few and far between, whatever that phrase is. So take the wins, because otherwise you get to the place I was in a month ago where I was like, you know, completely in the doldrums. So you need to take the wins to really re-energize. That's my roadmap to being a more effective everyday activist. And I would love to know how you motivate yourself. So let me know. Okay, now we're going to talk Ted Lasso season 2. Spoilers ahead, all the spoilers. So you can skip ahead if you want to hear quick takes, or you can hear spoilers. I personally love spoilers. Or you can listen, because of course you've watched Ted Lasso season 2, and probably more than once, like I have. I've by now watched season 2 3 times, because two and a half, because I watched the first half a second time before the second half of the second season began. So I've seen the first half 3 times and the second half of the second season twice. And I wanted to watch it again, because at the end of the show, when it was clear how completely nuclear evil Nate had gone, I then also read a Twitter thread by him, the actor who plays Nate, about the beats he felt were throughout the season that led up to him feeling apparently betrayed enough himself to betray. So I wanted to watch. I felt it was sort of like seeing the movie The Sixth Sense, and you want to go back and watch it and say, well, what did I miss? And the fact is, I didn't miss things, but it's the how the things that Nate experienced were clearly amplified in his mind beyond what a typical person would feel. Now, what do I mean by that? You know, the actor sort of made the point, and by the way, he's not arguing that the character did a great thing. He's just saying this is how, you know, when you're an actor and you're playing the villain, you still have to know what your motivation is, and you still have to, you sort of have to be on your own side. You know, you have to believe in what you're doing, what your character is doing, and understand why your character is doing it. So he just explained the beats. And the basic feeling was that Nate felt that, you know, Nate obviously had a difficult relationship with his own father who didn't really give him praise or props. Ted came in and smothered him in attention and respect and love and made him a coach by the end of the first season. And then a little bit into the second season, when it became clear that Ted really wanted Roy to join the coaching staff, Nate began to feel like the fourth wheel, or whatever the equivalent of that would be, because Beard obviously is Ted Lasso's longtime confidant and colleague. Roy was clearly someone Ted really wanted to get on board, and Nate felt like he was left behind, so that he was elevated to a pedestal and then came crashing down and was low person and last on the list. And it was exacerbated by the fact that Nate got all this attention for having saved the game where Ted Lasso had a panic attack and ran off the field, and Nate became the star, and he became the wonder kid, so to speak, his own misspeaking of wunderkind. And he was getting all this positive attention, and then Roy came on board and they started talking about the Roy Kent effect. And so it wasn't just his own, you know, in real life relationships that were, you know, lifting him up and then dashing him down, but it seemed like the whole world was. So that's kind of the explanation. And so when someone like Rupert comes and whispers in his ear and flatters him, it really reminded me of like Iago and Othello, or, you know, this kind of snake, or the Lord of the Rings, when the Mad King had like Wormtongue whispering in his ear, you know, and filling him up with flattery and just oily and unctuous, and that this was a person who was ready to absorb those messages and act on them. And so, you know, that's kind of, you know, the arc. But if you were watching the season without knowing in advance that that's where it's going, as of course a rewatch would let you do, you might notice some of the little beats, some of the little moments, but it still wouldn't add up to this kind of visceral anger and hatred that Nate portrayed. It just didn't make any sense. So I really wanted to watch it again and see, okay, well, was there more of that than I remembered? Was there repeated indignity? It's like, what are we talking about here? And the answer, too long, didn't read, is no. There's like a handful of little incidents, which might be considered, some of them, cheerful ribbing, that Nate just took to heart in a totally different way. And so he is really Nate the Snake. It's not okay. I could not buy his rationalization. But let's talk about also how the seeds were planted for this in season one. Someone brought up to me that the very first time you see Nate, he is running across the field yelling at Ted and Beard because they're on the field. He knows the new coach is showing up, and they're dressed in a kind of an athletic jacket. You know, they don't look like... the fact that he is running and yelling at them when he's too far away to know who they are, that's how he starts on the show. And there are also a couple other moments in season one where it's clear he has a bit of an edge to him. And you know, you're meant to perceive him as this super nice, shy, retiring guy. But when Ted puts him in a position to actually share his thoughts with the team at large, he does it in the form of almost a roast, where, you know, and it kind of builds into this maybe not as mean as he gets to Colin in season two, but it really builds until he's being pretty mean, and it's taken in the spirit of a roast, so people aren't really getting hurt, but he's got a little mean streak there. And then still in season one, in the last episode, when he thinks they've replaced him as the equipment boy, he has some pretty nasty words for Rebecca, because he immediately assumes he's been fired and it's her fault. And then, of course, he finds out he's been made coach. And so there's all this jubilation and celebration. And so it's easy to forget that his first instinct when he thought something bad has happened was to blame, you know, the woman owner of the team with some pretty harsh words. So the table was kind of set in season one that he has a little bit of a mean streak in him and a little bit of a hair trigger temper or reaction too. So in season two, the beats that the actor brought up that definitely happen are that, you know, at one point when they're trying to figure out before Roy is on board and they're trying to figure out how to get through to the new captain of the team. And, you know, he's in his head, he's not performing well. And so they're all the coaches, well, Beard and Ted Lasso and Nate are there. And, you know, Ted was sort of saying, no, I think he's a big dog. He needs a big dog to talk to. And so they're all thinking, and of course, Beard and Ted kind of know each other well enough that we assume they're in sync on, well, that means Roy, who's not there, but Ted wants him to be there. But Nate says, I guess I'll do it then. And Ted's initial response is to laugh and think he's making a joke. Beard knows he's serious because Beard has witnessed, Nate has exercised some of his meanness to the equipment boy, to Colin, when Ted isn't around, but Beard has witnessed a little bit of it. And so he knows that Nate is serious. And then Ted says, oh, you knew he was serious? And he says, yeah. And he goes, no, thanks, Nate, that's okay. So he rejects clearly doesn't think of him as a big dog and rejects his offer to help. And then Roy comes on board. And the other little thing that happens is that Jamie told Keeley he still loved her, and he's furious and he confronts Jamie. And then there's this great scene where Jamie just sort of admits he was wrong and Roy wants to be mad at him and hit him or whatever, but he forgives him. And so then Nate thinks he's taken it like a man and he's going to stand up and tell Roy that he tried to kiss Keeley. Well, he did kiss her when they were out shopping. And Roy says, oh, yeah, I know about that too. Don't worry about it. And Nate is basically insulted that Roy is not threatened by him. So it's very tied to Roy. And yet, if you watch the season, Roy is not mean to Nate. Like, he gives him credit. He gives him pats on the back. There's more than one occasion where he kind of not high fives because Roy's not like a high five kind of guy, but you know, the equivalent of a attaboy, Roy does. So it's not like he comes on the coaching staff and tries to supplant Nate. He is, really good at knowing how to, you know, praise a team member and try to build team camaraderie. But Nate is just way too far gone down the I've been replaced road. There's just a couple of other things that happen. Like Ted doesn't have Nate's picture that he gave him for Christmas in the office. What he doesn't know is that Ted has it at home next to a picture of his son. He doesn't ask. He just tells him, you don't have it here and I don't even rate that. I don't know why Ted didn't tell him where it was, but the point is these are these really small little things that, you know, okay, so maybe Ted wasn't giving him the constant positive reinforcement that he did in season one. But by the way, Roy gave him positive reinforcement. So it's not like he did not have regular positive reinforcement. It just wasn't always coming from Ted. And Nate knows better than anyone that Ted has shit going on. So there's just this incredibly like self-involved, self-important aspect to Nate that was the seeds were planted in season one and that he just totally cultivated in season two, because on the one hand, he's like one of those characters that has like this inferiority complex, you know, which we're led to sort of attribute to his withholding father. But he also has a sense of entitlement. Once he's given a little positive reinforcement, he blooms into someone who like wants, you know, and thinks he deserves this kind of positive reinforcement all the time. So it's a really interesting saga. Now, there have been some complaints that, well, why was Nate as a character who's a person of color, like why is he made the villain? I think, you know, it's interesting because on the one hand, you know, I think there's a common thread sometimes that you hear where people say, well, you know, we'll have really made progress. You know, I might say it, well, you know, we'll have really made progress when mediocre women get to run companies, because that will mean they have really achieved parity with men. And in the acting world, there's there's sort of a similar thing, which is we know we'll have made parity when we're allowed to be villains, those of us who are from, you know, a underrepresented group. We're allowed to be villains where the villainy isn't connected to our identity, which is a bad person. So because a lot of times you have these tropes of the saintly gay friend or the sassy black friend or the, you know, the people who are very one-dimensional, or they're the villain. You've got the character from Silence of the Lambs who, you know, it's part of his villainy. You know, so they're like, what if we could just be people who got to be all shades of good and bad? No matter our color or our ability or our gender or our orientation or our identity, whatever it is. So on the one hand, I'm like, okay, well, so did Ted Lasso earn the right to have their villain be a person of color? They also had a person of color who was like the unexpected hero of the season in Sam. You know, he's Rebecca's love interest. He's the star of the team. His character was completely up-leveled in season two. He's the one who made major changes in the way they behaved and the perspectives that they had. His relationship with his father was sort of offset against Nate's relationship with his father. And also, you know, this whole idea of father and sons, you have Jamie and his father having an extremely problematic relationship. You find out that Ted and his father, there was sort of an arrested development of their relationship due to Ted's dad's suicide. So you have all of these father-son relationships, and of all of them, Sam and his father, this is the one that you want in your life. They have this incredibly close, loving relationship, where Sam's father is not afraid to like hold him accountable when he's doing an ad campaign for a bad corporation. So, and in season one, certainly the villain was Rebecca, basically, until she had a change of heart. And so have they sort of earned that these characters are not necessarily falling into ethnic tropes to begin with, so the characters are freer to serve any purpose, to do anything, to be hero or villain, because it's not falling into a trope that connects their identity to their villainy or heroism. So yes, maybe. I do think when I look at it, you know, that I see this rich tapestry of characters, and there's a lack of one dimensionality throughout. They, you know, also I didn't even mention Sharon, who is you know, the black woman psychologist, who's clearly this catalyzing, compelling character, a breakout character of season two. Who is kind of on a different kind of, not necessarily a hero's journey, but she is the catalyst for so many hero journeys. And given her own, I loved that they gave her own dramatic incident that sort of shifted her perspective and changed her behavior. So it's not like she was some magic, the trope that's called the magical Negro trope. And I'll put a link to that because I didn't make up that term. It's a whole thing. And you know, she had her own life and issues that were explored. She wasn't just there to facilitate all the men. And she was extremely intriguing and you wanted to learn more about her. So I feel like they really have divvied it up so well that people are not falling into these tropes. When I think about Nate's parents, I don't necessarily think that behavior read that. I've certainly watched non-Indian media where the Indian parents are kind of turned into, I think about like Raj's parents on Big Bang Theory as one great, you know, immediate example where they're kind of turned into these stereotypes and pretty one-dimensional. And I didn't feel like Nate's parents read that way. I felt like they had, there was both a universality and a specificity to the way those roles were played. And so I don't know. It's an interesting, that to me is the interesting question. I felt that they had earned, you know, that Nate's villainy was earned and built and, you know, set up so that it wasn't tied to his ethnicity and, very interesting, but all this to say that he's a jerk, that he's a big baby. And I mean, if I could just end on the most immature, the most immature statement, I just really think he is a snake and Nate the Snake is the right name for him. And he doled out way disproportionately, way more than was deserved for these perceived slights that he read so much into. And I'm really curious what they do in season three, because honestly, part of me doesn't at all believe that Rupert would make Nate, 1 year away from being an equipment guy, the head coach. So maybe he's not. We don't even know that he's the head coach of Rupert's team. He might be an assistant, but, you know, is he going to get his comeuppance? Is he going to, you know, be a worthy adversary? Like, it's very, very, I am very interested to find out. And I can't wait for season three. And I'm mad it's so far away. What did you think? I just spoke for 20 minutes about Ted Lasso season two, one character's journey. So obviously I'm a little obsessed, but what did you think? Let me know. And now we come to the portion of the show that I like to call quick takes, which is just my quick takes on the things I've been watching and reading and learning since my last episode. Now, it's been a while since my last episode, so I really can't go through everything. So here, I'll have to spread them out over a few episodes to get to everything I did in the last month. But here are some things that I will put links to in the show notes that I want to bring to your attention. The first thing is that I have a new gig, a new consulting client that I'm working with, the Professional Business Women of California. And they have a series of webinars and an annual conference. It's all going to be virtual this year. And they have an interesting community partner webinar coming up at the end of this month that they're partnering with Trajectory Partners, which was founded by Maria Stark, who partially I love because her name is just so close to Arya Stark. But it's Maria, and you may know her because she is the founder of Emerge, which is one of those organizations that helps women run for political office and does trainings and things like that. So she goes back a long way in really being an activist and in really trying to change the equation. And now she's doing a new thing. And it's called Trajectory Partners, and she is going to be co-leading this webinar for the PBWC. And it's all about accountability groups and how you can leverage those to try to do more of the things you want to do. And I have, over these last 2 years with the pandemic, I have had some accountability partners. And I will say sometimes accountability partners become venting partners, but we're not doing any formal thing. I think that probably Maria and Trajectory Partners has a more well-structured solution that they want to talk to you about, along with other options that are out there. So it's really interesting. And I think It's the first one since I've been on board. And so I'll be sharing other links from them about what they've got going on. This is the next one. Similarly, I have two new bylines of my own for the Kinder folks, Kinder Beauty, Kinder Beauty's blog, where I talk about being a vegan and sort of clean beauty and things like that. And two bylines have come out since our last podcast. One is about the four climate evangelists you need to follow now. It's pretty amazing to most vegans who are aware of the environmental impact of a vegan diet that more climate change activists are not automatically vegan because there is such an environmental impact. But I want to focus on the positive and tell you about the four who are. And these are young and old men and women from different parts of the world, but they all often came to their climate change activism through an initial animal welfare-based veganism. So it's interesting. My other one is my whole thing about, forget resolutions, try forming new habits. And here's how I did it. You may or may not know I have this not resolutions, just habits hashtag. I've been using it now for, I think we're on the third year. I welcome anybody else to join me using it. Nobody does because it's a very long, it's really a poorly planned hashtag because it's super long. Anyway, this piece for Kinder was about how I came to try to change the way I set goals and to really break things down into the little habits that will help me achieve the goals. There are also links to the latest pieces I edited for the Rosie Report, where I continue to have a really good time curating great content about the future of work. Elke Govertsen has a piece she wrote about creating your own role and how to define a job that's at the intersection of what you want and what they need. And this is where you can learn that Elke used to raise pigeons and sell them to magicians. So, where else are you going to get tidbits like that? Another piece is Tax Organization for Freelancers, Make 2022 the Year You Get It Right by Angèle Lafont. And she used to speak at BlogHer events about this topic. And she just has a really no-nonsense and easy-to-follow approach. So if you have been collecting many 1099s and have been many, really are feel like you're missing out on some deductions you could have, take a look at that article. And finally, my friend and colleague Brandy Riley wrote a piece also about habits. One good habit leads to the next at work and in life. And she talks about how I had a book that instigated me to this way of thinking, The Power of Habit by Charles Duhigg. And she had a different book called Atomic Habits, which I may check out. And she really walks you through the steps she took to make better habits around her work life and how that kind of translated into her personal life as well. Then there are some things I want to share because I think they're really a good read and or listen. In the New York Times, obviously reproductive rights is a big, huge issue right now. And there's so much I could share about that. And maybe next episode, I will talk a lot about the places I see activism really happening and on the ground helping of women themselves who need the help to have access to abortion. But in the meantime, the New York Times had a really, I thought, powerful op-ed called The Abortion I Didn't Have. And it's a woman who writes about how she got pregnant, how she didn't have an abortion, how she loves her child, but how it was not a good thing for her to, be compelled. She was raised religiously enough to not have an abortion. And actually, in fact, she makes the case that she and her partner were raised religiously enough that they were, they felt like if they didn't use birth control, they could somehow be in denial about how they were inevitably going to have sex. Yes, they were very, very young, but this, I don't think she's talking about a rare phenomenon of how the human brain doesn't always do the make the most sense and do the most rational thing because we're human. And she talks a lot about her derailed life and her mental health. And none of this takes away from how much she loves her kid. But we don't hear that perspective very often. That sure, she went ahead and had the kid, and no, you know, it didn't translate into complete destruction, but it gave her a life that wasn't the life she wanted or needed. And I am constantly upset by the way, you know, pro forced pregnancy folks say they care about life, but it's really not the life of any woman that they care about, not ever. So it's very interesting and a perspective we don't hear. I listen to the Sway podcast, which is from Kara Swisher. It's also a New York Times podcast. And she interviewed a guy named Rutger Bregman. I've never heard of him before. And he has written a book about being somewhat having hope for humanity, basically. And so she, having less hope, titled her podcast episode, Why Humans Aren't the Worst. And what's interesting is he talks a lot about optimism, and that, you know, that could be good. And I urge you all to listen to it for that reason. But the thing that really just was like the big moment for me was at the very end, she asks him about if there's anything he's pessimistic about. And his answer was really, I think, a tough but important thing to hear. I feel like I should like not spoil it and tell you. And on the other hand, I'm like, oh, are you really going to listen to a whole, a whole podcast if I don't give you what it is? Basically, he talks about what he's pessimistic about is the state or the future of animal life because we seem unable to treat them less cruelly, despite knowing what we know and learning what we learn. And that was just really, really sad to me. And of course, he's way more articulate about it than I just was, which is why I urge you to listen to the podcast, and we'll have a link to that. Finally, I have a post on LinkedIn that links to an article which talks about how being poor all by itself is not what makes people homeless. It's being poor where housing is unaffordable. That's what makes people homeless. You know, it's like that simple trope about how do you make someone not homeless? Give them a home. And there have been municipalities and areas that have tried, you know, basically with tiny homes and other an apartment, you know, converting hotels or apartment buildings into homes, you know, that they've addressed it directly and they've seen good results. Well, this, you know, is kind of talking about the, before you get to that point, like, how does someone get to that point? And it's not just about, it's not just, as they say in this post, it's not just about poverty. It's not even just about poverty and mental health or drug substance abuse. It's if you live in an area where housing is unaffordable in general, it just trickles. It's unaffordable for everyone. Like it's more and more challenging as you go down the income and the options become less and less until, you know, the bar for where your options don't exist is so much higher, so much lower. I don't know. I should have thought that through. The bar is just so much more extreme that it just takes so much less to tip someone over the edge into being homeless. And I think that from my interview with the months ago with Destination Home CEO Jennifer Loving, I think she's the one who brought up the stat that usually the amount of money they have to give to a family to help prevent them from becoming homeless is less than $5,000. However, to give services to one homeless person is $30,000 a year. So, you know, it is so important and worthwhile for us all as a collective to want to avoid homelessness, not just because of how, like, if you needed more reason than just how terrible it is for the people going through it, how about that it just wastes so much taxpayer money? If you really need that as your driving motivation. Anyway, super interesting. And I will leave that for you. As always, I encourage you to come visit me in all my digital spaces. My website is elisacp.com. You can sign up for my newsletter this weekish, which is elisacp.substack.com. And it operates like a blog in that you can comment and talk to me that way. Of course, I am at Elisa C on Twitter, at Elisa CP on Instagram. And I want to thank my host, Messi, and I want to thank my nephew, Ryan Christopher, for the music that you hear, intro, outro, and interstitial. you know, if you like what you hear, please do share, subscribe, and rate and give a comment and review. All those things really would help me out and I would appreciate it. Happy New Year, everyone. Happy 2022. I still, knock on wood, am doing my best to avoid even this Omicron variant, no matter what people say about how you're just inevitably going to get it. I'm trying to be, I think there are going to be millions of people who don't get it. I'm trying to be one in a million. What can I say? So take care, wear your mask, get boosted, and stay safe. Get your flu shot too. And if you're over 50, get your shingles shot. You know what? I got my first shingles vaccine dose and I had no side effects whatsoever. So everyone was scaring me about that and I had none of that. So take care of yourself, do all the things, and we'll see you in a couple of weeks.